Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What makes for a great vacation? Depends on who you ask. Are you looking to get away? Or bring everyone together? Do you want to get outside and play? Or see a play at the plate? Fortunately, however you operate, I'm the destination you've been looking for. The name's Missouri, but you can call me Mo. And I have just one question. What's your MO? To find your MO, tap now. Or for information on safe travel, come see me at visitmo.com.
It is instant match reaction for Everton 1. Crystal Palace won. European hopes take another body blow at Goodison Park. It wasn't a defeat, but it feels like one. The one positive tonight, Mark Moseley, is that we are watching this together, socially distanced, rules adherent, all that kind of thing. So at least we got to share the frustration and the angst and all those things together in person for the first time in a while.
I'm just doing that standard thing that we do after disappointing results now, where you get the league table up and see what could have been and how many points off Leeds and Crystal Palace we are in order to consolidate that top half finish. But yeah, the ability to watch games with friends and family and get back to some form of relative normality of watching Everton is a highlight on an otherwise very disappointing afternoon. But I think the reality of getting together and watching Everton in that sense is that you realise that Everton don't really change. I think Gary Neville summed it up pretty well on the Sky Sports coverage over here in that Everton always manage to get themselves to that pedestal and to that next step. Success is always on the brink. You always think that we're going to be the ones who kind of break the top, whatever it may be, 4, 6, 8 at the moment. But yet again, we consistently find a way to throw away every form of advantage that we have. Tonight seemed like one of those games that was just going to peter out into a relatively disappointing, we were poor but we made it over the line sort of performance, a la Southampton earlier in the season. But I think worryingly that it struck me as one of those results whereby a lot of people could possibly disengage after that, knowing that such a big opportunity has passed us by.
Yeah, it was a different sort of frustration, wasn't it, to what we had recently? Because I think if you look at home games like Burnley, you know, Fulham, you know, the famous list we've all been rattling off in the last few weeks, you know, they've just been absolutely rotten performances. When Everton have done nothing, you know, really, and when they scored, it sort of felt like it's a bit by accident tonight. They actually had chances and missed a load of those chances, and that's not something we've been able to say after the match for a long time. And I don't know about you, but I'm just like pissed off with them all after that. I'm pissed off at the strikers for not being clinical enough. I'm pissed off at the midfield for not controlling the game better when we get 1-0 and, you know, you want to take the sting out of it. I'm really annoyed at the defenders, and particularly Michael Keane, for switching off when you go into that mode later on in the game. And I'm annoyed at the manager as well for sort of going into that shape when, and, you know, being that negative when we've been on the front foot and creating chances so much. It's one of them where it feels like everyone's got to take a bit of a slice of it tonight.
That was a classic tale. You mentioned Ancelotti, whereby you kind of set your stall off for the last 15, 20 minutes and then you've got absolutely no answer going forward. And I think, well, Everton had no offensive answers going forward from the minute that Gylfi Sigurdsson had to come on early, because other than Josh King, who's been relatively underwhelming, we always knew that if we had to change the game for the positive, it was going to be a real struggle. And you do have to anticipate the fact that might happen in the last 10 or 15 minutes. I appreciate that we've got players on the pitch, even at that late stage, who are capable of nicking it for us. But sometimes you just need that freshen up and that change up top, and we're just not capable of doing that at the moment. And I appreciate that the injuries and things have really taken the toll on the squad this season. But the one area where it really hasn't been an issue is at the back, as you say. I think even before we start making changes with Godfrey, I think we seemed relatively comfortable, I would say. I think for all of the mistakes that Crystal Palace were making at the back and Everton were managing to jump on them and create chances, I don't really feel like we gave a great deal away. So yeah, the frustration definitely comes from there for me. But I think the main area of angst for me really is that if someone would have told me before this season started that we'd throw away a really good, promising, potential European finish by getting beat at home to Burnley and drawing at home to Crystal Palace, it's probably a narrative that you'd totally get on board with back in April, because these are the sorts of run-of-the-mill struggles that relatively decent Everton sides in the last 15 years have really toiled with. And I think everything that we invest in new Everton and Carlo Ancelotti in particular has been that things like this are going to change. We're going to know how to manage games well. I don't necessarily think we did that very well tonight. And we're going to be able to manage particular points in the season very well. And right now, I think if you offered most people in late March, early April, the ability to be on the cusp of greatness in terms of relative Everton greatness, which is a European finish, the idea of having Ancelotti behind you is the difference. That's the key factor that gets you over the line and into those challenging spots. And at the moment, I think everyone's just kind of waiting for that to kick in. And yeah, I reference injuries again, that they have definitely impacted us. And I think my frustration with the squad is that regardless of the millions that you spend on that midfield, it consistently looks like the weakness. So I think this is round about the point in the season where we were expecting more answers than questions, but I think it's very much vice versa at the moment.
And you know, it started off slowly, didn't it? I think both teams were really rusty early on. You know, we're losing it in midfield, and you know, a lot of our chances early on came from us pinching it and trying to get forward, and you know, Gomez played to Richarlison ridiculously early on when he was miles offside. Then he plays Richarlison through and he misses that chance. Calvert-Lewin misses the chances. And I mean, there's going to be a lot of focus on those two lads, isn't there, in the aftermath of this? I think, you know, Richarlison in particular had a ton of opportunities tonight. Yeah. Calvert-Lewin has two probably clear opportunities that he should score. And, you know, listen, I think that's 3-15 for Calvert-Lewin now, so he's obviously in a bit of a rough patch. And sort of taking him first, I think we've said this for a while now, that's still the area of his game, isn't it, where you'd say he needs to make a massive step if he's going to become a real top-class striker, that when the ball's sort of ahead of him and he can take a touch and pick a spot, you never really see him wrapping into the corner, like what Rodriguez did tonight with his finish, you know, put it in off the post. He's better when it's instinctive and he can get up on the end of things. It's still that when he's got time to think, he can't quite pick a spot. You know, listen, it's something he might get better at, because he's defied people before in regards to what he can't do and what people have said his limits are. But that's still the one area, I think, where if you've got a player like Rodriguez or you've got someone like Richarlison, Fred, and passes through to you, you're going to get those chances quite a lot. And he needs to be a bit more clinical and a bit more composed in those areas.
I'm going to call that Thomas Radzinski syndrome. he was always great, great instinctively. But
that's a bit harsh on Tom.
If he had more than half a second to have an opportunity on goal, it went straight into the upper glottis. But yeah, a great point you're making, that is the reality of having good creative players, which we hope that James Rodriguez is not the last of to come in the next couple of years. You are going to get time on the ball because they are able of crafting those spaces for you. And
the thing is, his movement's great. Like in the Holgate pass, he gets onside really well. The other one he times has run really well. So he's learning that part of the game as well. It's just that little bit. And like, I think if he can get that right, he will go on then. And he's probably got another 5 goals this season. He's the top scorer in the Premier League. And, you know, there's no ceiling, but it's probably easier said than done, isn't it? But if he just takes a bit of a deep breath when he gets into those situations, you'll be a lot better.
He's ironically great at getting into those spaces, as you say, isn't he? And usually the kind of niche role of getting into the intelligence side of being a striker in terms of getting into the really clever positions, that usually comes last. And I think Calvert-Lewin has probably got there a little bit quicker than he has with his finishing potential. He's very much a victim of his own ruthlessness in front of goal here in the season, really, isn't he? I mean, the fact that we can talk about an Everton striker who scored 3 goals in 15 games, but he's still, what, second or third in the Premier League goals table. I mean, it's not to say that we expect less of Dom, because the first half of the season has shown that he is very much capable, but the reality of the start of our season and the fact that we did have everyone available and the football was a lot more fluid is that you are going to get a lot more of those relatively glaring opportunities that are seemingly harder to miss than score. And I'm not taking anything away from him for the, what, 15, 16 goals that he's already scored this season. But when it gets into the crux like this and you haven't necessarily got all of those midfield creative players behind you, it does need you to dig something out in those moments. When what was the game that we played him through one-on-one recently? It was the West Brom away game. It was a very similar miss.
Just a bobble, wasn't it? And he could have just wrapped his foot around it and he just seemed to take his time.
Kind of let it run onto his right and miss. And it was a very similar miss to the one that Richarlison put him through on tonight. All of his build-up play, the endeavour will always be there with Calvert-Lewin, but it all looks a little bit more laboured than earlier in the season. Flashbacks to the very early Dominic Calvert-Lewin that a lot of Evertonians knew and for so many reasons hated, because it's not the Calvert-Lewin that we ever wanted to see. And as I say, the angst of this is that we've seen the striker that we want to see. Forward players go through runs of form like this. Richarlison, I think the one shining light of Richarlison night tonight is that he was getting into those positions. We've gone 6 or 7 games at a time without seeing him get into a goal scoring opportunity as good as 2 or 3 of the chances that he had tonight. Obviously the one in the first half where he kind of cleverly lets the defender jump ahead of him and then takes a touch inside. They're the types of things that an on-form striker absolutely buries. And you know, both of them are in an area of the season whereby we need one of them, like Calvert-Lewin was earlier in the season, to be absolutely firing. Quite frankly, Everton have played relatively poorly tonight, but if we'd have gone in, you know, 2-0 at half time and then took another one and we ran out relatively convincing winners, I don't necessarily think anyone would have had any major complaints about that. But play poorly or be clinical, and you need to choose at this stage of the season whether you are going to be that ruthless team who does take small chances like that and just have that little minor gap over teams like Tottenham and Chelsea just to take those chances. And quite frankly, I've just got no trust or belief in Everton being that attack-minded or that aggressive with it. I feel like if Europe happens, it's a nice thing and other teams will have slipped up to let us in there. I don't necessarily see us being a grabbing the league by the scruff of the neck team quite yet.
We've had the chance to do that, haven't we, suppose, in the last few weeks when teams, you know, have been slipping up. And it's a mad season and, you know, there's things to take into account. And, you know, I don't think there'll be many supporters and many teams at the moment who are saying their team is playing exceptionally well. It's a bit of a grind for everyone. But, you know, we do get ahead in the game, though. I think at the start of the second half, it was feeling very familiar in regards to how it had gone. It was 0-0 at half time, and we've seen so often that, you know, the other team can take the initiative and push on and get in front, and we've tended to struggle. But, you know, Palace had a little flurry after half time, we still had to weather the storm, and we score from the best bit of football that we play in the match, really. And, you know, again, it's Sigurdsson has the shot, Dom's an inch away from putting it in, and then, you know, like I was saying, I think Rodriguez was the only one really that we had tonight that, when the chance did come, showed that composure. And they showed the great still on Sky, to be fair. And you know, there's nowhere to go. It's a little bit like, I think you said it was like Lee Carsey's goal in the derby in 2005. It reminded me a little bit of Andy Johnson against Arsenal, where there's like a tiny little bit of net for him to aim off through a load of defenders' legs, and he just found it somehow. But it was nice having back tonight, wasn't it? And there were times in that second half where Rodriguez got the ball and it looked like he was just playing a different sport to everybody else. Composure, drawing people in, knocking into space, you know, making space for other players by just taking the ball in tight areas. And I think actually when he went off, albeit he could barely run, we really did miss him. Just you know, someone to give the ball to him, just so everybody else could sort of take a bit of a breath.
I think when one of you back, well, when one of you back seven heads the ball out, in which it was very much the case for Everton in the last 15 minutes, you need that outlet, don't you? I think very often we think of a counter-attacking outlet in those situations as being someone who's incredibly dynamic, very quick and powerful, and they're going to, you know, run it into the corner for you and buy you 10 or 15 minutes. It doesn't necessarily always have to be that. It just needs someone who's got a little bit of composure on the ball just to find a clever pass out to Luca Dean, find Richarlison, who we know is going to eat up the ground and eat up a few minutes. Gylfi Sigurdsson, in theory, should also be that person who's just relatively cultured on the ball, going to take a little bit of pace out the game, but also going to be quite sensible about how he does it.
He went missing tonight, did he?
Clearly, he's not that player. Yeah. No, I think you are absolutely craving someone like Hammers to do that for you. And as you rightly say, take a chance. I think as much as we talk about Everton potentially of being more ruthless in front of goal tonight and being pretty convincing, we are that player away from really toiling and potentially going on to lose the game. And for so often, and all the stats will point towards it this season, he is a difference maker. I know there'll be so much frustration amongst, I'm sure, coaching staff, but primarily fan base, in terms of how often we've been able to see this lad. Yes, not in person, but on the TV. Quite frankly, if he was that consistent and as good as he is, he probably wouldn't be playing for Everton. Mm-hmm. But I think the first time we saw him tonight, just skip inside, watch a defensive midfielder go past him and then spray a ball out to Luca Dean, I think everything felt a little bit more right with the world, didn't it? It's so good to see him do that sort of... I think what we were worrying about with James is that the whole kind of choreographed relationship he had with Luca Dean had been very much well rehearsed by a lot of defences in the Premier League, and in that brief moment I thought maybe everyone's just forgotten how good this lad can be. But yeah, it all needs to operate around him, doesn't it? I think the movement ahead of James Rodriguez will always be consistently good as long as Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin are in the team. They're very clever players, and on their day they're very clinical players as well. But I think what you do need with someone like James, who relatively unfairly, I would say, can get labelled as a luxury midfielder or a luxury attacker, is you need that stable core behind him. If people like Alan and Decore, yes, we expect them to be that, and to an extent, Gbamon, who it was great to see, obviously, tonight. But I think we are back to the old argument in that when you start stripping away at that midfield, and you are left with people like Andre Gomez and Tom Davis, who was particularly poor tonight, I think James Rodriguez becomes a very dangerous player for Everton to have. He's either going to be the difference maker, as we hoped he would be tonight, or he's someone who you admit pre-game that you're probably going to have to bring off at 60 to 70 minutes, bring another defender on, and you've got absolutely no answers to replace him. And I think it was a little bit too much of the latter for me tonight.
Would you have brought him off when you did?
Well, in an ideal world, from a technical and a game management point of view, I think absolutely not. But I think the reality is that most Evertonians don't really ever argue about James coming off, because the acceptance and the understanding is that he hasn't really got loads of 90-minute runs in him. So it's frustrating, but I think it's not in the same extent as, you know, if we bring someone like Richarlison off tonight, we're talking about it for throughout the week on every show we've got. The reality of James is that there is a caveat and an asterisk next to his name on that team sheet, because you need to utilise him for the time you've got, because it's definitely not going to be the whole 90 minutes.
Yeah, and the one other change, obviously Gomez went off in the first half, James comes off Godfrey comes on for him, doesn't he? We just had loads of defence. We had loads of defenders on at that point.
Tell you, but came on at one stage.
Coleman came off, then he put Godfrey. Yeah, Godfrey. That's right. And then James comes off as well, but for Jean-Philippe Gbamon. But I think that change for Godfrey for Coleman, I think, was... I could see the logic behind it, because Zahar and Bernardo were getting loads of joy down that left-hand side. That looked like their outlet. But I think what happened when Godfrey came on, and I think this is sort of what happened with the goal, he just wants to engage, doesn't he, all the time? He wants to get up in someone's face and say, try and beat me one-on-one.
With Zahar in particular, yeah.
Like, you know, and he probably looked at that and thought, you know, he's the best player on the pitch. I'm going to try and try and get near him. And I think he got done by him early on. And then in the goal, he doesn't really go past him, Zahar, but he just drags him out. And I think what Coleman maybe will do a little bit better is just sit in that position and say, you know, you can have the ball there. I mean, it's Michael Keane, isn't it, on the goal? And I think I think for me, it's a centre back who is playing on the right of a back three. He's not playing on the right of a back three very often. Who, you know, if you put someone there who plays in that system regularly, they're probably a little bit more aware sometimes that the wing back can get forward and leave that space. Whereas if you play in a back, you know, more of a compact back four, that space is typically filled, and he just gets attracted to the ball, but. You know, I think even so, you're looking for a bit more from an experienced player. Mm. You know, for Keane, it's, you know, he's obviously been out the England squad, a bit of a blow for him there. Missed out on the cup game before all this as well. And, you know, competition's high at centre back at the moment, isn't it? Yeah. So, you know, these lads are going to have to keep setting high standards.
I do kind of get it with bringing Godfrey on, because I think if any of us were asked who's the best one-on-one defender at the club, and who would you rather, you know, if Wilfried Zaha is picking it up level with our 18-yard box and being pretty direct, then I'm relatively comfortable with Godfrey doing that. But as you say, that all kind of gets unravelled if you take Godfrey out of that sort of very structured back five. And playing four centre-halves across that back five, as it became, the idea is that it is pretty rigid and you don't wander out of position. And if someone like Zaha does want to peel off you by 25 or 30 yards, then unfortunately you've got to let him go and let someone like Gylfie Sigurdsson, who was relatively close to Godfrey in that phase of play.
He was playing right, wasn't he, right midfield?
That's it. Yeah. You've got to let him kind of do that role. The fact that he's only been on the pitch for 5 minutes probably gives some form of nod towards why we hadn't sort of structurally set up in the best way. But I think, Sigurdsson's reaction to the whole move annoyed me. I appreciate that Michael Keane is probably the one who has to step to his right and fill in, but it was very much the same old from Sigurdsson in terms of finger-pointing and wanting to pass on all forms of responsibility. And I'm not saying that the goal is necessarily his fault, but for a senior player, you do expect that level of nous defensively in critical stages of the game. And I think if for anyone who watches the highlights back, you can kind of see the frustration that Everton fans have held with Gylfie Sigurdsson all in one fluid movement, because on the highlight reel of Sigurdsson wandering around and pointing, as we've seen at places like Anfield and the Emirates and similar big games where you expect senior players to stand up, he is the one who shirks responsibility a lot of the time. And maybe it was just highlighted by the fact that I think he'd been pretty poor since coming onto the pitch. But yeah, it's for all of the defensive joy and flexibility that Everton have in terms of team selection at the moment, I feel like we do need to kind of nail our colours to the mast in terms of, are we going to play with two fullbacks who we allow to go forward? And I think if you are going to play with something like that, you need a very good defensive midfielder to be that pivot in front of the back four.
I think Seamus Coleman's playing well at the moment, isn't he? I'd happily keep him at right back or right wing back.
I think the only shock about the Godfrey substitution for me was that obviously most people could see that everything was coming down. Crystal Palace has left. I think most of us were expecting Godfrey to potentially come on at right back and Seamus Coleman just to stand in front of him at sort of a very defensive right midfield position and see if they could break down a sheer amount of numbers on that side. I don't know, the temptation for me would have been to ride it out, and I appreciate this is all with hindsight, but as much as Crystal Palace's play was very much focused on that side, there were very few rare occasions, other than maybe the Eze shot where he comes inside, where I thought we've really gotten away with one there. I felt that it was relatively well managed, and maybe comfortable is a bit too far to go, but it didn't strike me as a situation whereby we needed an immediate like-for-like change at fullback because Coleman was getting destroyed.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were a couple of occasions, but when you come up against players like Eze and Wilfried Zaha, they are going to come past you at times, but the reliance from an Everton point of view then is, well, we've got three centre-halves in the 18-yard box who should be able to deal with any delivery that comes in.
Yeah, some talk about the goalie being a fault over on Sky. I think maybe a bit harsh on him there.
I didn't see it. I think the main criticism was that he'd come out too soon. I think if you're going to label a goalkeeper with that sort of criticism, then it's got to be pretty eye-glaringly, you know, responsive in terms of coming off
his
line.
It's right in the corner, isn't it, to be fair?
Yeah.
It's a good finish, to be
yeah,
fair.
Yeah, absolutely. So. I think 9 times out of 10, it either hits Olsen's leg or it gets dragged wide, doesn't it? I think the fact that it nestles in the corner obviously doesn't do Olsen any favours, but definitely not one that we'll be talking about as a major glaring error from the goalkeeper.
Yeah, and finally, Jean-Philippe Gabamin came on the pitch, which in itself is remarkable. Couldn't help but laugh at his big, massive smile when he came on. He just couldn't help himself, could he? Bless him. You know, some nice things he did on the pitch, some ropey things, which you'd expect. But,
yeah.
Surely the main positive to take from tonight is just that he's on the football pitch.
And, back.
Yeah, and it was hilarious, you know, as if trying to hold on to a 1-0 lead at home when the opposition are putting pressure on you isn't anxious enough. We had the situation where every time anyone went near him or he was on the floor or something like that, we were panicking and nervous about him getting injured as well.
I think the thing that I'm most nervous about, and I think when you see players come back from injury like that, you're right in that you just want to see them get through minutes and get through games. And I think the difference with Gabamin, even though we've only seen him for what, an hour, was it, of his debut about 47 years ago, the difference with Gabamin is that this is not a player that Everton fans are talking about as coming back into the squad and being a key member of, you know, a 25-man European squad. He is someone who Everton fans realistically talk about as being part of our strongest midfield three. And to come back with that level of pressure on his shoulders, and whether he feels that or not, I'm not sure, but I think if you were to ask most about the sort of most solid midfield three, it would include him, Alan and Abdoulaye Doucouré, and that's a massive weight to put on a lad's shoulders who's obviously really struggled physically over the last couple of years. But yeah, it's been a bizarre timeline for him. I think back 4 months ago in November we were talking about him getting back into full training, and then when he eventually returns into full training, announced by Everton Twitter admin by posting photos of him.
People demanded for snaps.
he's suddenly back on the sideline. And God, at one point when Gomez went down, you thought, surely this lad is not going to get drafted in at this stage. But yeah, it would have been a nice situation to not necessarily need to see him tonight. But I think we're all just hoping that he can become, for everything that we've just said there about the back four in terms of relying on a really stable and clever and always in the right space on the pitch defensive midfielder. He is, fairly or unfairly, someone who we have cited as being that man. And I mean, the last, what, 9 games is it now, were a big opportunity for him to show what he's capable of going into next
season.
Might
have to start next week. We've got the
midfielders. Oh, God, yeah. Gomez isn't back, absolutely, yeah.
Every central midfielder who's signed in the past 2 summers is injured. Delph, Gomez, Gabamin, Alan, Doucouré.
At least we're not talking about Delph being the one to be that Gabamin role.
Yeah, fingers crossed he can get fit for next week. No, we'll get off that. But yeah, disappointing. Yeah, West Ham's on in the background here, and they're 2-0 up at Wolves, so they're not slowing down anytime soon. Hopefully Everton can find something and cling on to a European spot in the final weeks of the season. It's Brighton next Monday as well. At least everyone had the Easter weekend to enjoy before Everton stepped in and ruined it on Monday. But it's been nice watching it with people again in person. Obviously, be looking forward to doing more of these shows with more people throughout the course of the campaign. So cheers to Mark. Hope everybody's had a great Easter weekend. Not ruined too much by what happened tonight. And we'll speak to you again soon here on the Blue Room.
Progressive Insurance protects people's cars, homes, and other vehicles. But if you've ever seen our commercials or even just heard our name, you probably already knew that. What you may not know is that we support Humble Design, a nonprofit that furnishes homes for families and veterans emerging from homelessness. Because a little help goes a long way. And a lot of help. Well, you get the idea. Now, if you already knew all of this about Progressive Insurance, we're impressed. We'll have to find something else cool to tell you next time. Find out more about how we're dedicated to our customers and communities at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. You've had enough staying home. You've had enough confinement. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds, like the breathable, silky, smooth Tree Runner, the responsive foam and extra grip of the Tree Dasher, or the classic low-top look of the Tree Piper. Allbirds has a shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Whether you're traveling to the ends of the earth or settling in for a staycation, you need a shoe that's versatile enough to go with any outfit, durable enough to wear over any terrain, and lightweight enough to make packing a breeze. Being made from insanely comfortable, breezy eucalyptus fiber is a plus, too. When you wear Allbirds tree shoes, you're in vacation mode before you even leave the house. They're the only shoes your suitcase needs. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair of tree dashers, runners, pipers, and more at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.